I feel it's important. And sometimes I don't know where that boundary is. Where does the medical issue stop in terms of my role and responsibility?
Hi, I'm Dr. John Oden. This is Memoirs in Medicine, a podcast featuring the personal stories of healthcare professionals.
And I'm Dr. David Spiro. On each episode, one healthcare worker will share a moment from their career that has profoundly affected them and provide one suggestion, no matter how big or small, for improving the practice of medicine.
Through storytelling, we hope to highlight the humanity in healthcare and create a space for candid and respectful discussion.
To protect patient privacy, some details may have been changed, but the stories are real. Welcome to Memoirs in Medicine.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Dr. John Oden, and alongside me is Dr. David Spiro.
Yeah, it's an incredible honor to be here today with Dr. Erica Liebelt. She's a colleague of mine at Arkansas Children's UAMS and is an attending physician in our pediatric ER, but also serves as the director of our toxicology and pharmacology service.
Oh, yeah.
And Erica and I have crossed paths at Yale and at University of Alabama, and incredibly fortunate and honored to actually be working with her here. And the goal of this whole thing is to have an amazing story to tell. And we thank Erica to being our first guinea pig or guest on our show. And
yeah, with that, welcome, Erica.
Welcome.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me, David. It's a real honor to be here. I have never done a podcast before, so this is all new to me, and I'm a really old lady. But like David said, I joined the faculty of UAMS and work at Arkansas Children's Hospital. I came here about a year and a few months ago, April of 2021, right in the middle of the pandemic. And I've been very, very fortunate to be part of the very robust pharmacology toxicology service at Arkansas Children's Hospital. So I'd like to tell a story about a patient that I encountered a few months ago, if that's okay. So I got called from the emergency department by one of my colleagues a few months ago about a young lady who had ingested multiple pills. And this is not an uncommon reason for why any of us on the Farm Talk service are called. And based on the history, the presentation, and the workup, she needed to be admitted. So it was a Sunday evening, and it was early evening, and I live really close to the hospital, so I wanted to come in and see her that night. And when I walked into the room in the emergency department, I introduced myself, and she looked a little bit familiar to me. But the first thing she said to me was, "I remember you," and then it all came back. So we're going to backtrack about 5 weeks earlier when I first met her in the hospital. When I walked into her hospital room and introduced myself, and again, it's a little bit what I've learned in the last 15 months is sort of where to draw the boundary line about medical issues. I talk with the patient and the parent or caregiver, and then the psychosocial and then the mental health issues. So I think from a medical standpoint, I told her she's going to be okay. But I ask many of these adolescents questions. Sometimes they respond and sometimes they don't. I said, "Why did you take those pills?" I said, "Did you want to kill yourself?" And she looked at me and she said, no, she didn't want to kill herself. And then for whatever reason, because many of these adolescents don't open up, she started telling me a little bit about her situation. And then I started asking her more questions. I try to ask them about school and what's going on because of the pandemic. And she said she was back at on-site school, but she was having a really hard time. She didn't have any friends. She was getting bullied at school. That's what she said. A lot had changed. She had recently moved to a new house. So anyway, I told her about how I felt she needed to go to an inpatient psychiatric facility, and she was very hesitant. "I don't think I need that. I've heard bad stories. I'm afraid." So we talked a little bit about that, about sort of the goals of these inpatient facilities. And I asked her, I said, what do you want to do in your life? Like, do you have any goals that you've set for yourself? And she looked at me very, very surprised, saying, no, I don't have any goals in my life. My goal is to make it through the day. And, you know, there was a lot of more discussion. I was very honored that she opened up to me. And so then I'm going to fast forward to the ER visit when I walked into the room and I said, what happened? You did this again. And she looked at me and she started sharing something about how she felt she left a little early and she was overwhelmed and anxious and depressed. But then she said something to me that just wrenched my heartstrings. She said, you know, Dr. Liebelt, you're the only person that's ever asked me about goals and what I want to do with my life. And you gave me hope. And I'd never felt like I had hope for a future. And I just about started crying in the room.
Erica, I want to ask you a question. So in that moment when she said that to you, can you just elaborate a little bit about how you felt as a provider? Because we've talked about a little bit of physicians being vulnerable in the moment and expressing their own personal emotions. So did you actually cry? Did you feel more internal? Like what was going on for you and how did you actually respond to that?
I didn't cry. I thanked her for that comment. What I didn't tell you guys is how I started sharing some experiences with her about the pandemic in our previous encounter, about how I had felt isolated and that it's not wrong to have feelings. And I usually do not do that, to be honest with you, with these patients. Like I said at the beginning, sometimes I feel it's important and sometimes I don't know where that boundary is. Where does the medical issue stop? Where does the mental health issue in terms of my role and responsibility? Because we have great social workers. We have great nurses who spend much more time with these patients than I do. But I actually spent a fair amount of time in her room that first encounter. So when she said this to me, the second encounter, I thanked her, but I also told her that it's okay. We need to admit her medically because she was having a few symptoms, but she was going to be okay and that we need to continue with getting her help. And this was a journey. You know, dealing with these mental health issues, it's not like a medical condition where you treat it and it's over and you forget about it.
Yep.
You know, and getting help is so important. Talking to other people is so important. That's all part of the healing process, but it doesn't just end
right
after one encounter.
That story really resonated with me, Erica. I appreciate you sharing that because, you know, in what I do, when we're talking about kids with new onset diabetes, a couple of things that I've taken away from other attendings and some mentors is connecting with that patient, right? I mean, and sometimes it is just like, as you described, there's like one piece, one statement that you make, and it just really hits, you know, your patient in the right way. And it kind of gives them a perspective that they didn't really have before. And I think you did a great job with this kid that you kind of hit it in the right way and kind of showed her that there was some hope in the world. In my example that I will give you is when we have a new onset family sitting there in despair, thinking about chronic disease and all the things that they're going to have to learn. The one thing that they really resonate with, most of them do anyway, is the fact that we tell them that it's, you know, none of this is your fault. I mean, we specifically say that because in our community, diabetes is miscommunicated a lot of times and people think that your child developed diabetes because of what you fed your child. And that's not true. And that's something that I give to families every time I meet with them. And I think that resonates fairly well with them. So I do like your story because it reminds me of those families that kind of brighten up a little bit when you say that, and they kind of breathe a sigh of relief, and the stress level, you can just kind of palpate at the beginning, but the stress level just kind of detensifies there. And I think your story illustrates that very well.
So Erica, I have a question just for our audience, because we have some medical folks that are listening and non-medical folks. Can you very specifically explain in general what your role is when you're engaging with these families? What is your exact role?
My role as a medical toxicologist and a physician, I think, is twofold in this scenario. Number one, the medical issues associated with the ingestion or the overdose of pills. And honestly, that is much more straightforward. I know what an overdose of an antidepressant, an antipsychotic, an anti-anxiety medication can do to an individual. I know what to look for and why we need to bring them in the hospital, what tests we need to do, how long to monitor them. And a very, very common question that the patient and or the caregiver asks, I get asked this fairly frequently, are there going to be any long-term effects from this particular ingestion? And 9 times out of 10, the answer is no. There are a couple of select situations where I might change my answer just a little bit, but those are very, very rare. The second responsibility I have for this patient is, do they need further mental health services? Now, I have help with that. But, you know, we in the emergency department, David, as you are aware, and John, I believe, this screening also takes place with any adolescent that enters our health system. They get screened for depression and they get screened for risk of suicide. And it's a 10 to 15 question screening. Even if a patient comes in the ER with a laceration on the arm, they are screened for mental health, high risk mental health situations. And so part of that, you know, when the social worker does a screening, many times it's pretty clear that the patient is high risk. You know, they wanted to kill themselves. They had a plan to kill themselves. There's a family history of mental illness, and or they've done this previously, like this girl. So most of the time, the patient and the caregiver are on board with going to an inpatient behavioral health, mental health facility. However, there are times when the parent doesn't want to do that or the patient doesn't want to do that. And that's when it becomes a little tricky, because both have to be on board with the plan. And furthermore, they need to be on board because if they go to these facilities and don't participate or engage any of the treatment, then it's not going to be a benefit. So I've learned another big part of the process where if a psychiatric facility has accepted them, they talk with the parent at length or the caregiver to find out extensively, is everybody on board with this? And then I didn't know whether to mention this, but another part of my role in the ER and as an inpatient is to ensure that they're medically stable to go to these facilities. I consider that an extension of my medical toxicology evaluation and treatment.
There's a lot to unpack here. So as a non-toxicologist, but a pediatric ER physician, I, like you, have the responsibility of going in and making sure they're medically stable in the moment, or if they're not, what we need to do to get them to become medically stable. And then oftentimes these children are transferred to another facility for their psychiatric support. I walked into a room the other day, and oftentimes I'll ask these children who have tried to commit suicide, what's going on? What's going on in your life? You know, just, I will sit down for a few minutes and just open it up for, and oftentimes I don't get much of a response. But the other day I was taken back, my own mini story here, as I said, what's going on in your life? And the child 14, 15-year-old male adolescent said to me, "No one loves me in my life." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I don't feel love from anyone in my life. And that's why I'm here today." And he was articulate in that response. And the thing that I really want to unpack here, because there's so much to unpack, we could talk about the epidemic of psychiatric emergencies in the United States, and we can talk about the impact that COVID has had on that and the isolation of these teens, which has further enhanced the epidemic of psychiatric illness, which I think with all of us on this call, we've seen in our careers an increase in the number of mental health problems that adolescents are presenting with. But I think that the interesting thing about this case is really, what is our role as physicians when we encounter these patients? And I'm very interested in Erica's response to this child and how it affected Erica. And so that's my question back to you. You came to us today with this story, and this was impactful for you. We all went to medical school because we care and we want to make a difference. And then we get, I think, sucked into this idea that, you know, I'm going through my day, right? We're all going through our day. And then we have these moments, right? I don't love you, or you're the first person that's ever asked me about what my goals are. And it's like, oh my gosh, I'm here. I'm in this moment. There's no one else here other than me and the patient. And this is really affecting me right now. And so I want to turn it back to Erica and ask you, why did you bring this story to us today? And why was it so impactful for you? And what do you want to tell folks out there who are medical and non-medical about how this affected you?
Thanks, David. So it was so impactful to me because the pandemic was very, very hard on me. I considered myself a very resilient person. I'm very independent. I am very goal-oriented. I get things done. I was at a different job when the pandemic hit. I got the organization under control. We went all remote. We got processes changed and procedures changed. But I was very, very isolated. And what the pandemic has taught me, it gave me a very hard stop about my life, about priorities in my life, what is important to me in my life. And why did I go into medicine? And David knows, John, I had a very different job previously, still related to healthcare. But one of the reasons I moved back to the South was to be closer to my family, was to have the opportunity to interact in an academic center more than I had in my other job. Those social connections and the transition was a bit harder than I anticipated to Little Rock. I don't know if that's because, like, I've done this deal a lot in my life, but sometimes when you're working in the ER and it's just going on and on and on and on. And same thing with these types of patients. I had no idea how busy this service was going to be. I didn't. I'm not sure what I thought. So when that young lady made that comment to me, and, you know, sometimes I feel I'm not making a difference. And it's just, yeah, the patient's medically cleared. The Tylenol level's normal. Vital signs are normal. Patient's asymptomatic. She's medically cleared to go to the site. Because I'll tell you, many times these patients don't even have parents or caregivers with them. I try to call them on the telephone. I never reach them. And many times, like you said, David, I try to talk to many of these adolescents, and they don't say anything to me. Maybe it's a nod of the head. This girl was different. And I felt very honored that first encounter that she opened up to me. And I was heartbroken when I saw her initially. I'm like, why did this happen again? It happened within 5 weeks. But her telling me that she had hope, that is one thing in my personal life I have never let go, because I always feel there is hope. Now, sometimes I forget that, but even patients with multiple medical problems in the ER who I just can't believe their parents and how they deal with this. But, you know, I've talked to a lot of them and there's hope. And John, it's just like what you said, this isn't not the parents' fault. It's not the child's fault. There's hope. And that has been a common theme for me personally in the last 5 years. So those are my feelings.
So has it changed your practice? Have you changed the way you interact with these kids when you see them now?
Yes, it has a little bit. Initially, when I started, I really didn't bring up many questions about their psychosocial circumstances, their school, their friends. And now I try to bring it up and I try to ask, just like David, like you asked, what's going on, you know? And yes, I always ask the question, well, why did you do this? But many times there's not a response. The most common response is, I don't know why I did it. And it's hard to establish that relationship when they've never seen me before. And that's why I'm very, very impressed with our social workers that we have. You know, they have a little bit different approach, but, you know, they have a set of questions on their questionnaire. And many times they're able to establish rapport with these patients pretty quickly. I also think it's hard for the patients when they keep seeing so many different people. So who am I going to talk to? Who am I going to tell the answers to many of these questions that are quite personal and that I'm afraid to tell because I don't want to be labeled as being crazy or having mental illness?
So I want to just make one point and I'm going to ask you one pointed question, Erica. So in endocrinology, we kind of go towards the fantastical. We always think about things that are pretty rare, pheochromocytomas, Cushing's, those kind of things. We're lucky if we get a good hypothyroidism every day. That's kind of our bread and butter stuff. But when we do find those keys to why we became a doctor, that's what we call it. You know, we just kind of look at each other and we just say to ourselves, that's why we do this. It's because we can diagnose and treat, you know, thyroid cancer is another good one. That's why we do this. We can diagnose, we can treat them, we can give these families hope. My question is, did you find your reason to be in medicine with this case?
I did, John. And I felt fulfilled when I walked out of that room. It was room 4. I'm like, I'm so glad I came in Sunday night to see this patient because it kind of puts all the other chaos and things we're challenging with kind of a much, much lesser importance. So, yes. And I've been doing this quite a long time. And there are moments, there are ups and downs. I get asked this sometimes, you know, would you go to medical school if you had to do it all over again? And there are some times, I'm being totally honest with you, where I probably have said no, but you asked me today and you asked me that night, of course, yes. Because I knew once I made the decision to go to medical school, I was going to be a pediatrician. I don't have any kids of my own. So people sometimes find that very interesting. Why were you a pediatrician? And so I'm glad David asked me to think of a story, and it's so interesting because I could probably tell a lot of stories that were much more medically focused, I think. But this story comes back to me all the time.
Yeah, I just want to say that the story really impacted me. It reminds me of I had a period of time like you, Erica, where I was not in academia. So I was in academia and then I was out and doing other things and now I'm back in. And I've thought, I had an intentional thought as I've gone back into academia over the last couple of years, how am I going to contribute to the learnings of our trainees? And I also sometimes think, like, what am I doing in an ER shift? Because after practicing emergency medicine, and I'm sure John feels the same way, you know, it gets a little bit of a blur. You see these kids, they come and go and whatnot. And sometimes I think on a very high level, like, what is the most important thing that I could do on a shift? Because again, for those of you that don't know, there are medical students, and then above medical students, there are residents, and then above residents, there are these things called fellows. And then there's me, and I'm just making sure in the ER that no one makes any major errors, but things are happening, and most of the time, everyone's getting it right. So it's serious, and it's kind of kidding, but the most important thing that I do every day when I go to work is I bring kids popsicles and stickers. And if you see me, I'm furiously going back to the freezer, and I'm going to the sticker area, and I'm bringing kids popsicles and stickers. And I actually believe that that's indeed the case after all these years and all this training. Why? Because I pretty much know most of the time what's happening and can plan it out, where they're going to go, what the medicine is, and all that kind of stuff. But I would say, Erica, your story was so impactful to me, and it resonates with me because for me, what I do is when I bring a child a sticker and I make them happy in the moment, or a popsicle, that's something that probably, at least it's impactful for me, and maybe a few of the kids that I bring that experience to, they'll remember me as the guy that brought them a popsicle and a sticker, or their family will remember that. And you, as a woman in healthcare, and have such an incredible impact, not only on the female trainees that we have, and I know you have from the work that we've had together, but you also have a unique opportunity to impact young ladies who may not have role models and may be victims of sexism and suppression of girls in society. And I think that you're in a unique position to be a role model and to be an advocate and to be supportive like you were in this case. So you're my hero today. You have been my hero, but you are a hero. And what you did in this moment really inspires me to want to be a better doctor. John, what do you think?
Of course, I agree with you. I think she is a role model. I think it's a wonderful story, Erica. It's just a wonderful story. And it's one of the reasons why David and I have decided to kind of focus on this direction in medicine, right? I mean, we could always do how do you sew up a laceration, or, you know, what is hypothyroidism, or, you know, what is a pheochromocytoma? We could always do that. There's thousands of podcasts out there that do that. But this brings perspective in what we do. This tells the story of that one patient that brought a little light into your career and said, that's why you do medicine. That's why you're a doctor. And it illustrates two things. One is, A, there are those patients out there that we just have to look and find. And I see them. We don't see them every day. But there's also that perspective that doctors don't always have, it's not always ER, right? It's not always George Clooney and his rabble of people. It's always not always exciting, and you don't save a life every 15 seconds. Sometimes it's a little mundane and routine, and that gets to be a little bit old. So I tip my hat to you for other reasons. I tip my hat to you because you bring a really, really, really good story that illustrates what we do. And thank you.
Erica, just to wrap it up, if you had to summarize based on the story, what advice you would give fellow physicians who are managing children with adolescent mental health issues, what advice would you give folks?
That there is help out there, there is hope out there, and that for all of us to heal for whatever condition that we have, we need to seek out help. And that goes for physicians too. I think that the personalization of these patients and their conditions can be seen a little more than, and I'm not trying to just isolate ingestions or overdoses, but remembering that there's the medical condition, there's the mental health condition. And as John said, I think this overlays so much of what we see in medicine, but it's not as clear. We need to destigmatize mental health. And I think we have been making a lot of progress with that. If there's any silver lining in the pandemic, I think that's one of them. Being vulnerable and talking about these types of issues, and that the emergency department can be a place and has been a place as a refuge, because sometimes these adolescents, these young children, these parents, these care, they don't know where else to turn. So they come into the emergency department. And I am so proud of what Arkansas Children's has done in terms of augmenting resources, in terms of our social service and our now behavioral response team. We are specifically training nurses and social workers, and we're bringing on new advanced practitioners who have expertise in this area. I applaud our hospital for recognizing the need for this and how we need to be part of the help and resources.
Well, thank you so much. And the last thing I'll say is you said something that also resonated with me, which is the destigmatization of mental health issues. And it not only applies to our patients, but it also applies to our colleagues. And we need to be aware in this crazy world of medicine that we live in that we're human beings. Doctors can have their own mental health issues, and medicine can be a stressful place to operate. And we need to be kind to each other, and we need to listen, and we need to be compassionate about this entire issue, because it's an important one in our society that we need to continue to work on. I always think about 100 years from now, when we look back, what are we doing that's barbaric? What are we doing that seems just so incredibly cruel? And what you've done is given a light to something that I think is the last bastion of barbaric medicine that we practice, which is how we treat children with mental health problems in our country. And
yeah.
We all need to be doing a better job, whether we're pediatricians, whether we're parents, whether we're teachers, whether we're physicians. We need to be doing a better job in our society in managing this issue.
I agree. Watching out for each other. I think that's one thing to be doing, making sure that we have the guts to say, hey, you look like you're having a hard time. Can I help?
Yeah. Erica, you're my hero. Thank you so much for joining, taking time out with us and chatting with John and I and our audience.
Yeah, thank you, Erica. It was a pleasure to meet you, at least virtually.
Thanks a bunch.
Visit memoirsinmedicine.com to learn more about this program, sign up for our newsletter, or leave us a voicemail. That's memoirsinmedicine.com. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or in other major podcasting apps so you can have episodes delivered to you automatically on the day they're released. Till next time.